The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to City Bible Forum. My name is Janet Jones, and I'd like to extend a warm welcome to you, especially if you're here for the first time or even came for the first time last week and are back to hear more. Welcome to you. Just briefly how our meetings normally work. After a Bible reading, I'll be reading a section of the Bible that's found in your outline. I'll ask our speaker, Ian Powell, to come up and address us on the topic of extreme provocation, how to respond to real hurt. And while you're listening to Ian's talk, that'll go for about 20-25 minutes, feel free to take notes. And if any questions come up for you, you might want to use the white slips of paper in your handouts and write the question down. These will be collected at the end of the talk, and Ian will do his best to answer those questions on the spot in the time that we have left after his address. And without further ado, I'm going to read from the outline that you were given when you walked in. I'm going to read from the right-hand panel, which says Romans 12, and a selection of sentences or verses from this part of the Bible. Ian will be speaking mainly from the Luke passages that's found on the left of your outline, but I'm just going to read from the Romans passage. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, "It is mine to avenge, I will repay," says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Thanks, Ian.
G'day. Good to be with you. I like the story. I'm not sure if it's true, but it's a good story. Presumably in somewhere in America, of this truck driver who pulls into a roadside cafe. He orders himself a milkshake, chips, hamburger, sitting down to enjoy himself. Loud noise outside, in walk three bikies, outlaw bikies. And they walk in, they have a look around, and they sort of surround this bloke who's just minding his own business, eating his food. And one of them reaches down and takes his milkshake. One of them reaches down and takes his hamburger. The other one picks up the plate and begins to eat his chips. And the truckie doesn't look at any of them particularly, waits for a while till the guys move off. He goes over to the cashier, pays for his dinner, walks outside, gets in his truck, drives off. Well, the bikies went over to the girl who was behind the counter and said, "He's not much of a man, is he, really?" And she looked out the window and said, "I don't know if he's much of a man, but he's not much of a truck driver. He just ran over three motorbikes as he drove off." Now, it's very hard for us not to cheer him on, rather than to condemn him, to see him as a hero rather than a villain. It really is it's part of the human heart, and the human longing is to long for justice, to long that the bully would be overthrown, to long that the big, bad, outlaw bikie, you know, would get their comeuppance. And that guy was certainly provoked. He was robbed. He was humiliated. He had very little choice against three big, tough, outlaw sort of guys. And one of the great marks of your life and our life is how you deal with people who provoke you, who hurt you, who annoy you. Those of you who know bits about various parts of the world where there's ongoing trouble, parts of Europe, parts of Palestine, etc., realize it's almost impossible to solve those problems humanly. You see various sides killing each other, but if you were there 20 years ago, it was the other side killing the other side. And if you talk to side A and hear their list of grievances, sometimes going back hundreds and hundreds of years, in parts of Yugoslavia, it goes back at least 600 years, and you heard that side speak and hear what had happened to their great-grandparents and what had happened to their great-great-great-great-grandparents, you'd think, yeah, I don't blame you for killing and maiming and holding grudges. But then if you heard the other side story and hear what had happened to them and what happened to their great-great-grandparents, etc., you'd think, boy, no wonder you're killing and fighting and not going to let this go. And you think, this is almost unsolvable. And it's just, you've probably seen that in your own family, where someone has done something wrong, or the other person has perceived it as a wrong. Something has been done back, words have been spoken, things have been done, and it goes on and on until in the end the whole family is in tension. And people get angry. And the Bible speaks about righteous anger. It's a rare product. But there's an anger that you will have felt at times that is righteous. That is, you are right to be angry. Something evil has happened, wrong has been done, you've heard about it. Perhaps it's been done to someone that you love, which is sometimes the hardest sort to deal with, or it's been done to you, and you sense this is wrong. And that anger is a good part of human nature. That sense of that should not have happened. But the Bible's view is that righteous anger is a very, very delicate plant. And it's got a very short life before it mutates into hatred, bitterness, malice, revenge, and all the things that tear apart relationships and countries. It's a critical area to work out how do you deal with provocation, and perhaps to look at it best, extreme provocation. Now we're going to look at some of Jesus' teaching. It's the obvious thing that Christians look at. The part we're going to look at is from Luke chapter 6. It's sometimes rightly called the Sermon on the Plain, because we're told it was on a plain. It's very similar to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6. Some dopes have got no idea how things like this work, so, oh, it's the same sermon, just hacked and cut. No, it's not. Jesus was a travelling preacher when there was no such thing as recordings. You couldn't preach it once and put it on the net. If you had a message to go, you went to one little village, you preached it. You went to the next village, you preached pretty much the same sermon. You probably improved it as it got better. And you just gave the same sort of message with variations again and again here. So we've got a version here in Luke chapter 6. Who's he speaking to? You've got to go back to verse 20. One of the great things about the Bible is it gives you the context. If you want to know who's this addressed to, the context is almost without fail there in the passage. Just go back a little bit. In verse 20, it says, Jesus looked at his disciples and said. So he's not on sort of public television. This is not like Oprah, who offers advice to all people. So she's very big, as you know, Oprah, on the importance of forgiving people. She will order people to forgive, which I'm not sure if you can do that. Because she understands if you don't forgive, in the end, not only may you damage the person you don't forgive, but you will most certainly damage yourself. And she will give advice to any who'll listen. Jesus isn't doing that. He's actually speaking to people who've made a decision that they want to be part of his group, his kingdom. They're in the kingdom, as it were. So whether or not you see yourself as in that relationship with Jesus, that is, you've made him your king, your master, your guru, your teacher, your guide, your Lord, that sort of thing, or whether or not you're just looking at it, here's a chance to hear what Jesus says to his people, those who've tasted of his grace. But before I read you some of it, and I kind of hope you've never read this before, because one of the problems for some people, whether Christian or not, they've heard this bit of Jesus' teaching, but they've never heard it. Yeah, they've heard the words, but they've never got it. Just ask yourself this question. In terms of this last week or so, who have you prayed for in the last week? Who have you prayed? Now, you must say, Ian, I'm an atheist. That's okay. The studies show that atheists are very disappointing in the amount of prayer that they do. They do quite a bit of praying, atheists, which puzzles me. It's hard enough to get Christians to pray sometimes. But according to surveys, most atheists have prayed in the last couple of months for something about someone. Who have you prayed for? Just think, who have you prayed for? Well, let's listen to who Jesus says we should pray for. Who have you been generous to? I'm taking one of my daughters out tonight. We're going out to the theatre. We're going to go to a restaurant before it. I'm going to be Mr. Big Generous, etc. That's easy, to be good and to be kind and to be generous to my daughters. That's easy to do good to them, to love them. Well, let's listen to what Jesus says about provocation, love, etc. Verse 27. Jesus. But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those, this is the question asked, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt. Give to everyone who asks you. If anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. So who does Jesus say we should pray for? If we're his people, if we're genuinely Christian in any shape or size, because no one can seriously consider themselves Christian if they don't seek to practice what Jesus teaches later on in Luke 6. You'll say, why do you call me Lord and not do what I tell you? Right? That's just silly. Who should you pray for? You should pray for those who mistreat you. That's what Christians do. Everybody prays for themselves. I remember when I was an atheist at school, I prayed, waiting outside the headmaster's office. My father was inside the headmaster. I prayed. Right? Most of us pray for people who we like and love, our family members who are sick or in trouble. Jesus, that's not what he's on about. Pray for those who mistreat you. As people have said, turn your hate list into a prayer list. Now, it does all sorts of wonderful things for you psychologically, but that's actually not what Jesus is interested in. Who should you love? Your enemies. Now, what does Jesus mean by an enemy? He explains it in the next line, because Jesus often teaches in what's called Semitic parallelism, where you say the same idea in different words again and again. And you can often get what he means by the first statement, by what he says in the second statement. So you can see it here. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. So love is paralleled with do good. Enemies is paralleled with those who hate you. In case there's any doubt, when he sort of summarizes in verse 35, you look down the end of the next paragraph, Jesus says, love your enemies, do good to them. Now, previously he said, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. It's the same thing as far as Jesus is concerned. So when Jesus talks about enemies, he's not talking about people that you might hate, that you might think, oh, that is that's my enemy. He's talking about people who make your life hard, who damage you, who mistreat you, who misrepresent you, who slander you, who curse you, he says in verse 28, who slap you on the cheek, that is, who insult you. That's the one Jesus is saying. In terms of provocation, Jesus says, the real thing about being Christian, being one of his disciples, is how you treat the person who provokes you, who's making your life miserable. Now, if there's no one at the moment, there will be coming up. It's not that I'm a pessimist, it's just the way life works. People often say, oh, I've never had anyone like that. Well, just keep living, baby. If you get out of this life without someone doing it to you, even accidentally, you are, remarkably lucky. This is Jesus' freakish teaching. And freak, I think, is a good word. I used to tell one of my daughters, you're a freak. And she would get, no, I'm not a freak. No, you are a freak. Freak's a good thing. She thinks it's a pejorative thing. It's not. She had long red hair and beautiful brown skin. I'd say, you're a freak. And she'd say, I'm not a freak. No, it's a good thing. Jesus is a freak. It just means weird and outstanding. It can be pejorative. It can also be a positive thing. This is Jesus' freakish teaching. And unless you hear the weirdness of it, you ain't heard it. Because the natural thing is to say, that's just foolish. That's silly. That's perfectionism. It's extremism. No, it's not. It's just ordinary garden variety 101 Christianity, according to Jesus. How do you treat the person who mistreats you? You do good to them. Right? You pray for them. You give to people who ask you. You say, look, I can't go that far. I'll tell you what, though, I'm going to be a good person. And I'll be kind to my family. I'll be a good family member. I'll be a generous friend. I'll do that, and I'll lend to my friends, and I'm happy to lend to people in need as long as I know I'm going to get it back. Listen to what Jesus says about that. For people who say, listen, I'm not a silly extremist. I'm going to live sensible but good life. Listen to what Jesus says in verse 32, verse 34. It's important that we hear this. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. This is the stand. Jesus is using the word sinner in the way that we know all his contemporaries did. Sometimes in the Gospels he'll parallel that with even tax collectors and prostitutes do that. Tax collectors as the male extreme example of someone who sold their soul for money, etc. Prostitutes in that culture was the extreme example of someone who has sold their soul and body in order to make money. Or sinners, outstanding, you know, A-level, Olympic-style sinners. Even sinners love those who love them, and they don't. They do, don't they? I mean, Adolf Hitler was apparently quite nice to people close to him. He was good to his dogs, anyhow. Verse 33, if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? You think God's going to, oh, wow, put that down on his mark. Boy, on Judgment Day, he's good to those who are good to him. What Jesus is saying is, big deal. You've done nothing. No one needs to tell you love your friends and hate your enemies, because we do that naturally. It's like saying, Ian, don't forget to breathe today. Thank you. Right? So being good to people who are good to you is a nothing. And yet many times that's what people say, I'm a good person, I'm good to my family. Well, bully for you, Jesus says. Even sinners do that. Verse 34, if you lend to those you expect that repayment from, what credit is that to you? No point you standing up on Judgment Day having worked for a bank and saying, but God, look at all that money I loan people. No, you know, right? You didn't even loan it. And anyhow, you only did it if you thought you had a good chance of getting it back. Even sinners lend to sinners. See, you see what Jesus is saying? How you treat those who provoke you is the acid test of whether or not you've actually decided to be Christian. Now, you might say, boy, I would have thought if he's going to talk about relationships, he'd talk about the key ones, the ones that matter to us. Family, friends, you know, all the stuff about how to have long and enduring marriages that are happy, etc., etc. No, no, no. Although it's the key here, isn't it? Because, you know, love your enemies. If you've been married, that may be relevant, right? Love those who mistreat you. Many people who are married get mistreated. I mean, this is not irrelevant. But clearly, if you're supposed to do that for the out-and-out enemy, it'll be relevant to your marriage partner and to your children, even if you have children. Because they can cause you a bit of misery, and certainly to our parents. You know, that's what my generation do. We haven't had any real suffering, so we whine about our parents. Oh, they gave me a green bike and not a blue bike. I'll never recover. I know some parents do worse than that. But you hear what Jesus is saying. This is kind of wild teaching. I looked up a number of websites, and there are websites arguing, for example, there was one I looked at, it was an interesting website, that gathered statements to try to prove, and the person who'd done it thought they had proved, that love for enemies is a common teaching in all the great religions. You felt like saying, did you read your quotes from the Buddha? Did you read the quotes from the Quran? What they're often saying is, don't always retaliate. Now that I think you can find in most wise traditions. To not always pay back cruelty with cruelty. But they don't teach love your enemies. Right? Except Jesus. They found some, oh, and the Apostle Paul, oh, and the Apostle Peter, who were all just his prophets and apostles. You can get good wise teaching that will hint in this direction. But as a sustained position, this is Jesus. To love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, pray for those who mistreat you, bless, that is, speak well of and to those who curse you. That's a Jesus thing. It may seem crazy. In fact, why would we do it, frankly? I mean, why should you do it? Imagine someone, and I'm sure some of you could stand up here and say, Ian, have you got any idea how much this particular person has hurt me, or sometimes worse, hurt one of my children? You can't be serious that I should do good to them, love them, which doesn't mean in Jesus' teaching how you feel about them. The Apostle Paul spells out what it means to love them in verse 20. If your enemy's hungry, feed him. Right? If they're thirsty, give them something to drink. To love your enemy means to treat them as you would treat them if they were a friend. That's what it means. It's to do with how you treat them. The heart and the emotions will often follow that. If you want to foster your dislike of a person, you can make yourself angrier and angrier. One of the things that the Bible seems to think is that the heart and the emotions follow the actions. We tend to think when the heart and the emotions are right, then I will act. You'll never act. Why should we do it then? What is the rationale? Now, it needs to be said here very clearly, and I don't mean this rudely, because there's a lot of good advice. I've heard myself saying to people, not friends of mine who aren't Christians, you better work on how to get over that and forgive that person, or that anger will burn you up. It will destroy you. If you really want to hurt someone, make them hate you. There are a few better ways to really damage someone than to make them hate you. Because then you can go on holidays with them. You know, they can be in paradise thinking about what a jerk you are. And you'll have had that experience, won't you? Where you should be enjoying yourself, but you can't get your legitimate anger out of your system at that person. But that's not what Jesus argues. The way it works with Jesus is he calls on us to live in a way, and then, as has particularly happened with the work of Martin Seligman and others of late, they then think, oh gosh, actually it kind of works. So even giving money away, which the Bible has always said is a good thing, tithing. The Bible, you know, Martin Seligman, his work on happiness, not writing as a Christian, I don't think he is a Christian. But he argues, you know, give 10% away. ABC journalist, ha, do you mean, scornfully quoting Jesus, it is more blessed to give than to receive? Ha, yes, he says. Right? But that's not why you do it, because it works. Because it often feels the silliest thing. Why do we do it then? Look at verse 35. Love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great. What's the reward? You will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful as your Father is merciful. It's a family thing. Now, it's possible to misread this, because Jesus assumes in verse 30 that God is already our Father. But then in verse 29, he sort of says, you will be children. What's he doing with that? Because that sounds like a contradiction. You will be children of the Most High. He is already your Father. Which is it? Well, I think it's a standard way that the Bible speaks, where it says, this is true of you. If you live in this way, it will become evident. And the fact that you're a lemon tree will be evidence because you've got lemons coming out of you. It's that sort of talk. See, because one of the best definitions of a Christian... And try this one on for size. This is the one that Jesus seems to assume and work from. That a Christian is an adopted enemy. We are, as Christians, you are as a Christian, you could become when you become a Christian, an adopted enemy of the Most High. One of the problems, though, is you see that humankind, although the Bible consistently says we are the enemies of God, we don't believe it. Religious people don't believe it. They say, are you kidding me? Look at all the stuff I do for God. Look at the fasting I do for God. Look at the praying I do for God. Look at the foods I do and don't eat because of God. I'm not his enemy. He's lucky. You know, the world would be better if there were more people as good as me. And the irreligious person, well, they don't think they're God's enemy. They couldn't give a damn about God. Right? You know, they don't get it. That to live as if there is no God is to treat God with contempt. We are the enemies of God, but when we become Christians, not only do we get forgiven, but we get adopted. And that's what Jesus is saying here. He says, your Father, he is, what is he? He is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. That's me. I'm the ungrateful. And I'm a wicked man. There is a twistedness in my nature, right, that I give into far too regularly. In fact, it completely ruled my life for many years. And yet God is kind to me. He has adopted me. And what he's calling us to is to be like our Father, to love as we have been loved. Right? To be at that point, and this is shocking, God-like. You are not to take to yourself. There are certain things about God that you are not to even think about being. And the classic that Paul will pick up is the rest of our, don't place yourself as the avenger, as the writer of wrongs. That's God's job. It's the job we're all too happy to help him with, aren't we? I'm all up for forming vigilante groups. I've got a list of people, though none of them be missed, you know, that who could really do with a bit of a punch in the head. But I'm not allowed to do that, right? That's God's job. When we try to do that, we screw it up in personal relationships. Now, this is not the agenda for government. Right? That's a different thing which the Bible speaks about in Romans 13. This is about ordinary humans in our ordinary, horrible, broken relationships. It's person to person here. That's what it's calling us to do, to live like our dad. If you've been loved by God like that, the call is to love like him. Not to love like people deserve, because God help us if that's what God does to us, but to love us as we don't deserve. This is shocking teaching, and sometimes we learn it best by people who run into it afresh. Let me tell you briefly about Mossab Hassan Yusuf. And I hope you've had some chance to run into this guy. And if you haven't, if you're a book reader, this is a great book to read. I was going to bring my copy, but I've loaned it to an old mate of mine from school. And you can find this guy. Easiest way to find him on YouTube. There's any number of interviews with him. And, of course, as you'd expect, many attacks on him as well. He's called Son of Hamas because his father, Sheikh Hassan Yusuf, was one of the founders of Hamas, which is now in many countries considered to be a terrorist organization. They're the guys who run the Palestinian government at the moment. He was brought up as a very devout Muslim. His father sounds like a genuinely lovely man. It's lovely but painful hearing about how that relationship's gone wrong. But Mossab was put into prison. It was an Israeli prison. But the part, as often happens, and it was run by Hamas, so long as they obeyed themselves, Hamas run it. And he said what happened to him as he lived there was he got increasingly disturbed about the amount of violence, not just that he grew up with between Israelite and Palestinian, but within this, amongst his fellow Muslims, just the amount of hate and it troubled him. And he came out troubled, didn't know quite what to believe about what. He was walking through Jerusalem, and someone who didn't know who he was, or I don't think he would have done what he did, invited him to come to a Bible reading group. My hunch is, if someone had said, that's Mossab Hassan Yusuf, he's just been in prison as a terrorist, and his dad is the founding father of Hamas, and the Israelis regularly blow up buildings trying to kill him, I don't think I'll invite him to our little Bible reading group. Anyhow, someone who I didn't know who he was invited him. First thing they open up is Matthew chapter 5. And he talks about how this just absolutely rocked him, knocked his socks off. They read this passage. Jesus speaking. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbours, hate your enemies. But I tell you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. And he said he had never heard anything like that. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. Are you kidding? But he understood, even though at one level it seemed crazy, he felt the beauty of it. He felt the power. He felt this was the only thing that could heal the country that he loved so much and that was so torn apart. But he didn't know what to make of it, because he couldn't believe what the Christians were saying about Jesus. But he said, there was no teaching like this. It was so far above and so weird compared to anything that it took him 5 years to work out what to do with it. And in the end, at tremendous cost to his family and to his... In the end, he had to flee the country. He became a follower of Jesus. But the first thing that struck him was this weird teaching to love your enemies, to pray for those who persecute you. Because that in the end is what God, the living and the true God, the God revealed through Jesus Christ, is like. But where do you see God loving his enemies, praying for those who mistreat him and persecute him, blessing those who curse him? Well, have a look at the second reading, Luke 23. Two other men, both criminals, were led out with him, this is Jesus, to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they're doing. They divided up his clothing by casting lots. The people stood watching. The rulers even sneered at him. They said, he saved others. Let him save himself if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one. The soldiers also came up and mocked him. Now the context here, I take it many of you will know, at this point Jesus has been deserted by his friends. He's been through three mockeries of trials. He's been bashed up physically by three different groups of soldiers, and at one point it says they got the end of their spears and smashed them into his head and body. He's had his beard pulled out, which hurts. He's had his face covered in spit. He's had his back ploughed up by the Roman flogging. And at this point, he has been stripped utterly naked and nude. He's been laid out, and nails the size of tent pegs have been rammed through his wrists and through his ankles. till he's pinned up against wood. They've pulled the tree up and jammed it into a hole, and he's hanging up there. And the people who are responsible for it are not content with that, but they are mocking him as he dies. And he is praying, not for himself. We have many stories from crucifixions where the people, powerless to do anything, would scream down curses upon those who killed them and bring threatenings of God's judgment. He didn't do that. What is Jesus' concern? He's not just praying that he will be able to endure it. He's not praying that. He's praying for the people who are slaughtering him, who are humiliating him, who are mocking him. This is what God is like. And the original actually says, when it says Jesus said, "Father, forgive them," the tense used in the verb is the ongoing continuous. It's not just a one prayer. He's praying, "Father, forgive them. Father, forgive them. Father, forgive them." They don't really get what they're doing, because he can see the terrible danger people are in who are doing that to him. There are many examples where Christians have picked up this. We're not asked by Jesus to live to a higher standard than he lived. Not at all. We're empowered by his inspiring example and by the power of his Spirit at work in us. And you'll have had chances. I've had chances to hurt people who've hurt me. And I had one when I was working at a school for some years. The guy was the biggest vexation. I won't tell you the whole story. He really did a lot to hurt me and my friends and the work of God in that school. He was a leftover from a previous generation. And he made a terrible mistake, which I discovered. I was tempted to not tell him so he could get nailed like he deserved. But in the end, I thought, oh, rats. I have to love him. I can't pretend to be Christian and not. So I had to go and tell him, and then I had to help him undo it and to cover it. I'm not saying, hey, look at me. I couldn't pretend to be Christian and not do that. I hated doing it. I did it with a reluctant spirit. Was he grateful? Not at all. Did he stop being a bitch? No. Right? Didn't make a scrap of difference. But I had just done what you do as a Christian. Severe provocation? Not really. Love your enemies, pray for them? Absolutely. A Christian is never more Christian, more like Jesus, than when they're doing good for those who deserve the opposite. Lastly, there might be a picture of a boat there if you're lucky. Then I'll stop. Not that one. Sailing boats. Great fun. A couple of years back, one of America's greatest sailors was lost in the Atlantic, and when they discovered what had happened, the weight that was on the ballast that had attached to the keel had fallen off. See, what happens in life, things will push you over towards hatred. Winds will come that will really provoke you. What's going to hold you up from falling just into the natural sea of hatred and revenge and bitterness? This teaching of Jesus will. This is the ballast that even if you begin to find yourself hating, and this will right you again and keep you safe, right, against extreme provocation, to be like our Father, to love because we've first been loved. I'll stop there so we've got some time for questions and interaction.
Thank you, Ian. And I'm sure you found that a thought-provoking talk, as I did. If you have questions or comments that you would like to put to Ian, please feel free to make the use of the slips of paper in your handouts, and Jeffrey is coming around to pick them up from you, and Ian will answer them shortly. Whilst people are writing their questions, I'd like to tell you about what's happening next week. Next week, Ian will be continuing this series and speaking on extreme atheism. Atheism new and old. Is there a connection? And you may have found this talk really helpful and thought, I've got friends who might want to hear this. They're very welcome along next week. The next announcement is about introducing God. You also have in your outlines a small flyer telling you about this short course. This course will replace what we're doing on Wednesday night, City Bible Forum After Work, the crash course that some people here have done already. It starts on the 20th of July. It's just 6:30 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday nights, and it's going to be an 8-week course looking at the whole overview of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. What's the continuous story of the Bible? What's at the core of the Christian message? And there'll be plenty of chances to ask questions there. What happens generally is we'll be gathering for a short talk in a lecture room in St. Andrew's Cathedral School, which is just behind this building. And after that, we divide into small groups for supper and discussion groups. If you're interested in joining that, you're very welcome to indicate your interest on the clipboard that we have on the back information table. And next week, we will have sign-up sheets to register for that. And that would also be a great course for yourself or someone else who... you might know someone who's been curious about what the Bible is all about anyway and have questions they want answered. They're very welcome along. Well, I might hand back to Ian.
Friends, there's a series of great questions here, and I want you to realise that when I'm going to give you an absolute comic book sort of answer, that do feel free to take it up with me afterwards. What do you do if a Christian is mistreating you? You do at least two things, three things. You follow what's in Romans 12, which is just after a passage about life in the church. It's probably specifically about persecution, but also the difficulties of dealing with Christians, because we're all sinful, broken people, and we will mistreat each other, sometimes accidentally, sometimes deliberately, to keep loving, to keep forgiving, but also, I think, to, if it happens as a pattern, to consider talking with the person. I think sometimes Christians are not good at actually going and saying, sister or brother, are you aware this happens? But do make sure that you're not doing it in a fit of anger. Otherwise, the chances of that being useful are practically zero. But don't be surprised. It'll happen, they're everywhere until we get to heaven. Love your enemy. Why does God destroy Sodom and Gomorrah and hurt the Egyptians? Good questions. Sodom and Gomorrah and the Egyptians. I mean, the Egyptians were given so many opportunities to avoid it. They could have got in line with God easily and painlessly. They chose to keep on getting in the way. As I mentioned, God does judge. He will bring evil to an end. The reason Sodom and Gomorrah got destroyed, which was for years and years, as it says in Ezekiel, they were rich, arrogant, they cared nothing for the poor. Any society that is like that will bring upon itself the judgment of God. But he is slow to enter judgment and quick to forgive. But I'm not suggesting for a second, as I mentioned, God judges. But the thing that we are called on to do is to treat God the way that he has treated us in the here and now, which is with mercy and grace and ridiculous kindness. Turn the other cheek, Jesus says. Turn the other cheek. If someone slaps you on the cheek, turn the other one also. That's, I think, probably one of the most despised statements of Jesus. I've had a person say to me... I think Jesus is a fine moral teacher, and then within 30 seconds to say turn the other cheek is utter stupidity. It's the classic Australian thing. I mean, it's wider than Australia. Jesus is a great moral teacher, except when he disagrees with me, then he's a moron, which is why we all ignore him. This is common amongst religious people. They say, oh, he's a great man, Jesus, we just never read his teaching. It's better to say I couldn't give a fig about Jesus. Turn the other cheek, that's not a blow. Oh, nice pen. That's not someone who has punched you in an act of violence. It's an insult. It's a slap like that, which in many cultures is an insult. And Jesus is simply saying, "Don't." It's really about being publicly insulted. He's saying, don't return insult for insult. That is a distinctive of Jesus' teaching. September 11 led a lot of soul-searching after that. And I remember a BBC journalist talking to a senior Iranian Shiite Muslim cleric who said, you know, he's trying to make out that, of course, what had happened had nothing to do with Islam, etc. And he said, because surely, I mean, Islam would teach turn the other cheek, wouldn't it, like Jesus did? And the guy, the imam, stiffened. He said, no, he didn't. No, it doesn't. And the guy said, no, surely, because this idea that all religions are the same. And he said, but Jesus taught. He said, and the sheikh said, no, he didn't. He said, but it's in the Gospels. He said, Christians made that up. Why does he say that? Because Muhammad doesn't teach that. Therefore, Jesus mustn't have taught it. That's how it works. That's the dogma that's going on. They're all saying the same thing. If Muhammad doesn't teach us, Jesus couldn't have taught it. Where did it come from? Christians may think, I feel like saying, I could get a brain. Christians spend a whole time trying to avoid that commandment. We don't make the commands of God tougher. We try to soften them. But no, it means simply do not return insult for insult. One of the sociological benefits is you are a chance, possibly but not necessarily, and Jesus never promises this, of entering friendship if you don't enter the cycle of mutual hatred, because that means you're gone. If you don't do it, you're a chance of making... There's such great questions. I have to leave it one more. That there is, if you're called to be a judge or a jury, the Bible is clear that is different from the personal stuff that Jesus is talking about here. Romans 12 says don't seek vengeance. Romans 13 is talking about government. There are people who God has placed in the community to do justice. At that point, you're acting not as an individual. You're acting as part of God's societal order. But this is basically talking about ordinary family relationships. If you're in government or a judge or on a jury, the Bible says you must then seek truth and work within the law. Thank you. If you didn't get a good answer to questions, feel free to hang around. Next week, if you've got friends who are atheists, it'd be a fun time for them to be here as we look at that. I mean, I think they'd find it interesting. Thanks.
Thanks, Ian. And Ian will be hanging around for a few moments if you do want to chat with him or your question didn't get answered. Well, we wish you a good afternoon and rest of the week and hope to see you next week when we have Extreme Atheism. Dawkins, Starlin, and How Come. Hope to see you then. Thanks.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.